The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast July 9th, 2024. Every day, every day, every day, every day I read the book. Chapter 1, you didn't really get the love. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love with you. You good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked on KZSM.org, your true community radio station. Where today, the book under discussion is Lark and Termite by Jane Ann Phillips, and my guest is Dr. Jaime Mejia. Jaime is very recently retired from the English department at Texas State, where he taught Chicano-Chicana literature and rhetoric and composition. Is there anything else you want me to tell them about you?
No.
No? All right. You prefer to remain a man of mystery.
All right. Well, you know, it was great teaching at the university. Students were great. And, you know, I think you have to sometimes just turn the page and move on. And, but it was great being there. And, you know, being in San Marcos as well has been great.
Oh, good. All right. Jane Ann Phillips is the author of this year's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Night Watch, as well as seven other novels. She's taught at several universities and is currently professor of English and founder and director of the Rutgers University Newark Masters of Fine Arts in Creative Writing program. Lark and Termite was published in 2009. And as usual, I try a summary of the book as best I can. This one, it alternates between South Korea in July 1950, and that's during the war, and Winfield, West Virginia, in July of 1959. It's the same 3 days in July. The Korean sections are told from the point of view of Corporal Robert Levitt, who is accompanying a group of Korean refugees when they're attacked by American troops. He's wounded severely. He hides with a refugee family in a railroad tunnel. And as he lies there, we get his memories of his life, his thoughts about his pregnant wife, Lola, some hallucinations, and also his interaction with this family with whom he's trapped. The West Virginia sections are told from the point of view of Robert's disabled son, Termite, Termite's older sister, Lark,
great,
and their aunt, Noreen, Lola's sister, who's caring for both children. Towards the end of the novel, the town of Winfield floods, and the family is displaced. Anything to add to the summary?
It's a complex story,
yeah.
And it's a well-crafted story by a very, very talented writer. Obviously, getting a Pulitzer Prize suggests that she's got some great craft operating in this novel. Her recent novel that got her the Pulitzer Prize, Night Watch, is a comparable story, and it's also set in war. Mm-hmm. But I think certainly in both cases, a major theme for this author is the aftermath and the repercussions that for families and for people because of war.
Yeah.
And Lark and Termite is no exception to that. Although it's set, you know, obviously in the 50s, Night Watch is set during and after the American Civil War. They have a lot in common in some respects. They both feature families that have had some disruptions that have created problems for the members of the families. And Lark and Termite is no exception.
Yeah.
What we have with the title of the novel, Lark and Termite are two characters. They're both a brother and sister. They have the same mother, but they have different fathers, and that's part of the complexity of the novel,
yeah,
is to determine, you know, well, who are they, and what's going on. Termite is the son of Lola, who is the mother, and Termite is a mentally challenged, cognitively challenged young boy, and he's taken care of by his oldest sister, who is Lark, who's again fathered by a different man who the mother Lola is the mother of. But the thing is that Lola herself has a sister named Noonie, and both of them come from also a very odd family and a tragic family. And as daughters in the 1940s, they effectively leave their homes. First, Noonie, the older sister, leaves, and then Lola leaves, and things happen when they go down to Louisville, Kentucky, because they're basically in a town named Winfield, West Virginia, which again is above Kentucky, I think, or at least above Louisville.
The town is almost a character in some ways. You get to know quite a bit about it. Did you choose this book because she won the Pulitzer Prize for the other book, or why did you choose this particular book?
Well, you know, it's remarkable, but I'd never heard of Jane Ann Phillips, and her winning the Pulitzer put her on the map for me. And when I started reading up on her, I discovered that she had written a novel, Lark and Termite, which is set in part during the Korean War. And I have a fairly big interest in the Korean War. I know of several other writers, American writers, that have written about the Korean War. There's Rolando Hinojosa wrote The Useless Servants, which is set during the Korean War. Toni Morrison has a novel called Home, which features the Korean War. It's a very bad, a tragic novel. And there are other writers that have taken on the Korean War. And so I was very interested in Jane Ann Phillips' take on the Korean War. And that's really what drew me to this novel, is I wanted to see how she handled it, this tragic war. And that's generally what drew me to the novel.
Yeah, and she certainly makes it very tragic. The Korea sections, and I didn't realize this until I read this book. They depict an actual event, which is the massacre at Nogun-ri, which Wikipedia describes as a mass killing of South Korean refugees by U.S. military air and ground fire in central South Korea between July 26 and 29, 1950, early in the Korean War. Apparently, they thought that maybe this column of refugees was infiltrated with North Koreans or something. In 2005, a South Korean government inquest certified the names of 163 dead or missing and 55 wounded, and added that many other victims' names were not reported. The Nogun-ri Peace Foundation estimates 250 to 300 were killed, mostly women and children, and she depicts it, so far as I could tell, pretty much as it happened, and has this really sort of harrowing experience of the massacre. Oh no, I neglected to warn you that I like to read from the book under discussion. I hope that's because I want people to see what it feels like, you know. And this is it. This is Levitt, the protagonist of this section, and he's walking along with the refugees. Yeah, I'm on 72. I don't know if we have the same page or not. You'll be safe here. Levitt turns toward the tunnel and thinks the words the instant he hears the planes, but he's on the edge of the crowd with the boy in one clenched arm when the sky opens up. He's shouting to run for the tunnels in English and faultless Korean, to run for cover of the railroad bridges, but no one hears over the ack-ack of multiple fusillade raining down on them. Refugees hemmed in by the press of the crowd die first. They die on the tracks and the gravel. They die in the creek. Others crouch against the sloping banks in the shallow water until the planes pull off to circle for another pass. The unencumbered, most of them men, run for the fields and distant foothills. Those with children and the women, nearly all the women have children, one or two or three, and some a babe in arms, follow him, racing for the cover of the double railway bridge just ahead. The children are screaming. Levitt is running with them. And truly, truly harrowing. And what she doesn't say, I think she doesn't say in here, because Robert wouldn't know it, that the attack is deliberate. Doesn't he think it's a mistake?
I don't think initially he understands or knows what happened, you know, and I think he surmises once he's in the tunnel that it's American forces that are shooting at them, and but it was a very chaotic scene.
Yeah.
And what happened before they got attacked is that Robert Levitt, who is a fairly interesting and important character in the novel.
Oh yeah.
He's the father of Termite, and so he's effectively the husband of Lola, who's the mother of both Lark and Termite. And so Robert leaves the United States after he joins the army, and they send him to Japan. And in Japan, they send him over to Korea, and he's part of a group of soldiers that have learned Korean, and their assignment is to basically gather refugees and bring them south. And right before the attack happens, he has sort of is helping an older, a young woman who has a young brother, and the young brother is also cognitively disabled, and then they're also accompanied by an elderly aunt.
Yeah.
And it's the disabled or the cognitively disabled.
He's blind. Is he cognitively disabled as well? I know he's blind because
he's a character that's very similar to Termite.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Who's similarly cognitively disabled, but it's this young Korean boy who basically is able to sense things.
Yeah.
And he senses the planes as they're coming.
Yeah.
And that's what alerts Robert to basically move.
Yeah.
And he tries to get the refugees into this tunnel.
Yeah.
And that's where all chaos breaks loose.
Yeah, it's a remarkable remarkable scene. And you just mentioned that in the book, these soldiers who have learned Korean, which is kind of interesting. Robert is picked to learn Korean because he's a musician, and they figure he knows about, forget the word, about rhythms and cadences or something like that. But I don't think, from what I read of the account, it doesn't look like there were any Americans there at all, or that there were any Americans, I mean, there with the column of refugees.
No, there was a, you know, Robert Levitt was the leader of a platoon.
Yeah, in the book, but in reality. So I'm trying to make a...
Or whether there were any American
troops
with him.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that, in other words, that's something that that Phillips has added.
You know,
she's put this American soldier there so that she can show kind of the you're talking about war, her interest in war and its effect on families otherwise, I mean, so that she can show, you know, this is because Robert and Lola have a good relationship and they have plans and they're going to, you know, Lola is pregnant with Termite, you know, everything seems very hopeful and all of this is destroyed. And she, you know, by adding Robert and his, I don't know if it's supposed to be a platoon or what, and his, the others.
They're embedded with the,
yeah,
with the refugees.
Yeah, she sort of brings it home, I think, you know, but it's a way of bringing in that massacre. Do you have other comments about the Korea section? I want to move on to West Virginia and then go and then try to do the connections between the two of them. But if there's something else you'd like to bring up about those,
well, again, I think in, what was interesting to me once I discovered, you know, I mean. The Korean War began that summer. It was Robert Levitt in the novel is in Korea, just as at the beginning of the novel.
Yeah.
And this war would go on for at least two more years, and before there was some sort of armistice but this was a very bloody war. They had all the military capabilities that they derived from World War II. And so it was just a horrible war, and there was just a lot of bloodshed, and apparently the Chinese sent, you know, a million troops into Korea and to aid with the Northern Korean army. So, you know, what gets me about the novel and about Robert Levitt and about this attack on refugees is that it was very early on. There would be other atrocities in the war, mm-hmm. but this was early on, and that's what amazes me. It's right there at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I want to move into the West Virginia story for a while, and as I say, then we can go back to kind of the parallels, which are really, really important, I think. You said, when I did the summary, I described Termite as disabled, and then you said he was cognitively impaired. I think that those were your words. I mean, he's 9 years old. He can't walk or speak, and his vision is poor. He has use of his arms and hands, and he moves his fingers kind of compulsively, feeling the air, which is the way Lark describes it. And I've seen him variously depicted in reviews. One reviewer called him profoundly retarded, and another one said also called him autistic, which would be something quite different. And I don't really know. He doesn't speak, but he does this thing in which he and I'll read a passage on 37. Big storm they talk about, Lark is saying. Termite says back to me in sounds like my words. That's right, but you'll have to watch from the window. Don't think you're going to sit out here in the rain with lightning flashing all around you. He doesn't say anything to that. He might be thinking how great it would be, wind and rain, real hard rain, not like the summer rain we let him sit out in sometimes. He likes motion. He likes things on his skin. He's alive all over that way. Noni says I put thoughts in his head. He might not be thinking anything. Maybe he doesn't have to think, I tell her. Just don't you be thinking a lot of things about him that aren't true, she'll say. But no one can tell what's true about him.
No one can tell. And that to me is very interesting because he does, or at least he's portrayed as having a sense of what's going on around him. But he cannot communicate that he understands, and sometimes he's depicted as being able to say certain words that have just been said, and which seems to indicate that he has some understanding, but he certainly has a sense of the temperature of the weather. He has a sense of movement and sounds that are outside. He loves to listen to the train, which is behind their house. So he has some capabilities and he has some senses that sort of give him an ability to know what's going on. And I have to say that once I understood him in the novel, it reminded me of William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury.
Oh, yeah.
Where the main character, in fact, the first character in the first chapter is a kid named Benji. And so, again, that leads me to believe that Jane Ann Phillips is clearly influenced by William Faulkner, mm-hmm. and not just The Sound and the Fury and Benji, but Termite is very similar. If you read the first chapter of Sound and the Fury, mm-hmm. Very similar depictions of Benji that we see Phillips do with Termite.
Oh yeah. Well, the whole thing is, I think of it as maybe more than a challenge for the writer. But I'll get into that in a minute. We're almost up on our first break. So what do you think is? I assumed that Termite was suffering from cerebral palsy, and that was what, and that it had affected his cognition, but not completely, because his motor skills are also compromised, and that was what was wrong with him. I mean, did you have a theory of what was wrong with him, or did you just get so caught up in his consciousness that you didn't care?
No, I mean, I shouldn't say I didn't care, but I don't like to pursue like specific illnesses that that particular characters have. I didn't pursue it with Benji decades ago. And with Termite, I just sort of go with the flow and just trying to understand how he operates, mm-hmm. and what the relation is that people have with him, and certainly his sister loves him and understands him. His aunt Noonie also has a good relation with him, as do several other characters.
Right. Yeah.
Except for another character's mother, Gladys.
The horrible Gladys.
Yeah,
yes,
she's not sympathetic at all. But
no.
But I think you know, Termite is an interesting character because again it he draws people's reactions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And the point you make also kind of underscores, you know, here I am trying to diagnose him, and really any person is bigger than their diagnosis and more than their diagnosis, and you brought that out. And as I warned you, we are up on our first break.
On the radio, this is the Sweet Honey Bear Blues on Tuesday at 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock. You got me giving you what you just didn't know you needed.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliffe Collections. Subscribe to our email list today and stay in the know about all the great events, exhibitions, and news happening at the finest collection of literary, photography, and music holdings in the Southwest. The Whitliffe Collections is free and open to the public. We're located on the 7th floor of the Alkeck Library at Texas State University. For more information, please contact us at thewhitliffecollections.txstate.edu.
Welcome back to Bookmark, where we are talking with Dr. Jaime Mejia about Jane Ann Phillips' novel of the Korean War and consequences, I guess we could call it that, Lark and Termite. And we were talking about the central character, or one of them, Termite, who is somehow disabled or has cognitive difficulties. And the whole, and you know, you already were comparing him to Benji in Sound and the Fury. I thought of that too when I was reading it. There's other parallels as well, but and it's a real achievement, I think, for a writer to try to imagine the consciousness of someone like that. You know, here's another another passage of Termite's consciousness, just to see what it sounds like. All the while, he can hear Elise's car roll its big wheels closer until it turns roaring into the alley, but Noni puts him in his chair. She brushes his hair back with her two broad hands while the car throbs in the narrow tracks of the alley, crushing gravel to rattles and slides and bleating loud. He calls and calls and he wants to go, but Noni goes. Under the motor sound, he hears the car take her weight. A sigh before the door slams. The car roars away down the stones onto the smooth pavement and goes until it's gone. There's a shape in the air where the car was. He feels the shape hold still before it begins to end. Slowly the air comes back. The grass begins small sounds.
That's Termite's sense of, you know, the world around him, and we're given that kind of information about him,
yeah,
which makes him, you know, he's not a blank slate.
No,
he is understanding the world around him.
Yeah,
you know, he's, but it's at the same time, I think this sense that he has almost has magical powers, or you know he can, that there, you know, he knows things out there that humans can't see or know.
Mm-hmm.
And that ability that he has for us as readers gives us, elevates him, I think, and gives what his sense of the world value.
Yeah.
That I think is important.
Yeah, exactly. What did you think of the description of his experiences he's sent to school, but he doesn't like it and they don't send him there. I mean, part of some of the tension in the novel is whether Termite should be in somewhere in a school or somewhere where he can be taken care of. And of course they think that they feel that and the reader certainly feels that Lark and Noni, her aunt, are doing a better job of, and all their neighbors, of caring for him than the school would. And there's a scene in the school where I'm here in front of you. This woman is holding his hands, gentle but firm. The music goes again, and the hands beside his eyes are fat and damp. His head held fast in the cleft of a pillowy white chest. He can't move, and his breath gets fast and hard. He reaches, trying to go, his fingers going fast. The teacher holds his arms and jerks them once, two or three times, and smashes his hands together. The sound stings and cuts, and she grasps him hard, counting. His fingers race, and his heart pounds, and he hears the dull, alarmed thud of a heartbeat in the back of his head. And this woman is trying to force him to clap his hands.
Well, schools and education, you know, continue to have problems with handling disabled folks. And I was just reading an article last night, and the advocates for disabled people, whether they're blind or deaf, or in this case, you know, like Termite. The educational systems, these teachers haven't been trained, nor do they understand the kind of care that people like Termite will have. Yeah. And so, you know, finally, you know, in some ways, you know, with Termite, the care that he needs is the care of someone who loves him and understands him, and that's his sister. His sister, Lark, as well as his aunt. But
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting that you said that she's, we don't know if this person is trained or not, but she's trying to get him to do to clap his hands like a normal kid is supposed to do, you know, and she's determined that he's going to do it, and he gets more and more terrified. Did you have any more thoughts about the comparison to Faulkner, particularly The Sound and the Fury? I mean, there's other parallels that I read at some reviews. The book is divided into four parts. There's an heirloom watch, which is an important element in the plot in this and in Sound and the Fury and all of this. Personally, I think I like this one better, but...
I think Sound and the Fury is a highly challenging novel. It's very difficult. He's doing things in 1929 that I think few authors had done in American literature or anywhere else. So it's a difficult novel to read, and you really do have to understand what the hell, I shouldn't say hell, but the thing is, you know, Faulkner was engaging some experimentation with narrative, yeah. And there's no doubt that Jane Ann Phillips is doing the same, but you know. Almost a century ago, Faulkner was doing some interesting things, at least with narrative.
Oh, yeah.
But Faulkner's project was a greater project, a bigger project, with certainly the South and with the Civil War and the aftermath of the Civil War. And so I see parallels that Jane Ann Phillips has with Faulkner in other novels, like As I Lay Dying. As I Lay Dying, you know, this family is strangely taking
Mama's corpse to wherever it is to
Jefferson
bury her.
City to bury her.
Ugh.
And there's a storm that falls, and it's been raining, and they have to cross a river where the bridge has been swept away. There's no bridge. So this family is trying to get the body across the river that is roiling with just power, and they go into the river with this wagon, with the coffin of the mother's corpse in the back of the wagon, and man, it's one of the most epic scenes that I've ever read, and we see some of that epic nature in the flood, or at least the storm that creates a flood in Lark and Termite, and that's the next day. And so I was reminded simply that early on we're told in Lark and Termite that there's a storm coming.
Yeah, and it builds and builds, and they're talking about the storm, and they're getting ready for the storm.
The flooding that's going to happen. And Lark and Termite live in a house that's right next to a river, so they're going to get flooded. And so one of the things they do in preparation is to take food and other, like, candles up to the attic.
Yeah.
And they also take some boxes that contain some clothes and other artifacts that belong to Lark's mother, Lola.
Yeah.
And sure enough, when the storm hits, the flooding happens, and their house, that the water enters the house, and it's a very devastating flood for the house.
It seems in a way, it's a real flood, but it also, I think it's important, sort of in the narration. As I told you when I first started reading this, I didn't really get into it, and that's because it's clearly quite an achievement that she creates the consciousness of all these characters. I mean, but they're all kind of trapped and just sort of sitting there thinking, and everything that happens in the beginning, I mean, Robert is stuck in this tunnel, and the family is kind of trapped in their small town lives waiting for the storm to happen, and all of the action takes place in somebody's memory and not in reality. And then when the flood comes, it changes completely. And there are a couple of very dramatic moments in the course of the flood. And it's sort of like we almost need the flood to break everything open or something like that. I don't know. Is that a weird theory?
Well, again, I think Termite has this relationship with nature. And he can sense nature. He can sense the rain. He can sense the water of the flood. He can sense the animals that are outside. Throughout the novel, we see a cat that.
Yeah. What is with that cat? What was your take on the other people kind of barely notice the cat, but Termite always sees the cat and always knows what it's doing.
Well, in the very last chapter, mm-hmm. not to give too much away. The last chapter centers around Lola, the mother.
Yeah.
And she declares her relationship with that cat, which I shouldn't reveal. But I think what it says, again, is that Termite has, again, an understanding of nature and of animals and plants and rain. And so he has a sense of what's out there. And he has a sense of that cat. He understands when that cat is around. And I think the cat represents, you know, some protection for him. And I think when he can sense the cat, I think he can sense that having some security, having someone out there that's trying to protect him.
Hmm.
And I think we'll see that very clearly by the end of the novel.
Yeah.
With that cat, which is kind of interesting because, you know, we see that cat depicted throughout the novel, yet we don't really understand what the relationship is that at least the characters, and particularly Termite, have with that cat. But that cat keeps coming back, and so it's kind of an interesting, interesting thing.
Absolutely. I wanted to.
Need you to read a weather statement. You've got something.
Severe a brief interruption. Severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Caldwell County in south central Texas, northeastern Guadalupe County in south central Texas, and is there more? And it certainly looks like it's about to rain right here.
But they're talking about the hail and wind. That's what I need you to read about.
Hail damage. Okay, down here.
Yeah.
A severe thunderstorm was located near Zorn, or 9 miles south of San Marcos, moving east at 15 miles an hour, 60 mile per hour wind gust and quarter-sized hail. Ooh. ooh is probably not what a weather person should say, right?
No, that's what we're...
Yeah. Hail damage to vehicles is expected. You might move your car. Expect wind damage to roof, siding, and trees. For your protection, move to an interior room on the lowest floor of a building. This is kind of creepy because we've just been talking about the flood that is depicted in this novel. So, it is life and art, or some such cliche.
That infectious. That's what you're looking at there.
I can see the radar. Okay. What I wanted to get you into, Jaime, was the parallels between, because you could look, you could read this and say, oh, well, it's two different stories, but she does a whole, all kinds of stuff to weave the stories together. I mean, it's not just that Robert is Termite's father, but it's, there are all kinds of parallels. And I wondered, you know, kind of which one stood out to you and what you made of them.
Well, you mean the parallels between Korea and West Virginia?
Yeah, the parallels between the two stories, between the Korea story and the West Virginia story.
Well, I mean, that's a big question. I've been thinking about this a great deal, and I have to wonder, like, why was there a war? Why did the North Koreans and the Chinese invade South Korea? And why was the U.S. invested in this and sent finally just many, many troops to Korea and engaged in this war to such an extent that the U.S. had, you know, atrocities attributed to them? So I wondered, like, well, what was in Korea that you know, what caused the U.S. to be there? And of course, we had just finished, you know, World War II with atomic blasts in Japan, and you know, it was just an amazing situation. I mean, I would say that today, even today, we don't really. I mean, I don't know why. What's of any value in Korea that would cause us to have such a heightened, you know, military presence? And so my answer in the novel, you know, in terms of the parallel, goes back, for instance, to money and there's a scene during the flood when Gladys, I think is her name, the mother of Charlie, the mother owns a restaurant that has become a relief center for feeding relief workers that are helping people during the flood. Before Charlie had given Noonie, Lola's sister, a watch, and that watch was a very special watch, and it was had diamonds in it. It was a very special watch.
Charlie is Noonie's boyfriend, really, basically. Although Gladys detests her.
Right.
Because she thinks she's unworthy of their family or something.
Yeah,
which is kind of ridiculous.
So on that day when it's flooding, a friend of theirs named Elise, who owns a coffee shop across the street, has a car, and they are going to take Gladys home. This is Charlie's mother home. And so she sits in the back seat, and in the front seat, Elise is driving, and Noonie is riding on the passenger side. And it's raining really hard, and they finally get to Gladys's house, and it's raining very hard, but it's not flooding, and so they've been arguing the whole time, and once they Noonie helps the elder Gladys to her home, and carrying some food with her, but they have umbrellas and. They make it to their door and they go inside and they get into a fairly vicious argument. And in that argument, Gladys, the mother of Charlie, reaches for and takes away the watch that's on Noonie's wrist and holds on and does not let go. And she just won't let go. And she finally rips it off the wrist. And as she does so, as she rips this watch off Noonie's wrist, she falls backward into an open door that descends into the basement, which is flooded. But in the fall, Gladys, Charlie's mother, effectively dies.
Yeah.
And why? Because she thinks that this watch shouldn't have been given to
right.
Noonie by her son, Charlie. And I see that whole scene as, you know, it's been about money. You know, it's been about the social place that Gladys has. She thinks mm-hmm. she's above social class, above a working class Noonie. And she doesn't like as well that Lark is Lola's son and that Charlie's
spoilers,
son. So Lark is effectively Gladys's granddaughter. And she doesn't like that, but it's like there's more to the money in this relationship. But I think in terms of the parallels between why we were in Korea and why the action happens as it does in Winville, West Virginia, I think, as I continue to think about it, I think it's about the money. And it's ill-placed, in terms of like, we shouldn't have relationships with people. You know, it's just not humane to have relationships with people based on money.
Yeah.
Or based on social class.
Yeah. Since you brought up Gladys, there's more stuff to learn when you read the book. I wanted to talk about her. This is kind of right before the scene you're talking about when they call the restaurant civil defense because people do gather there, and you know that's where they do resources for the flood when the flood relief comes. So we threatened to leave her at civil defense, which is what Charlie calls the restaurant, when flood relief moves in. Finally, we pile her in the back seat with 2 cloth bags of food, bags that won't break if they get wet. Gladys sits between them, simmering with insult. I should think he could spare a moment, she says. I've given my life to him, but there's no point in saying so. I suppose you have, Gladys, Elise answers, since so have certain others. I'd say you and Noreen have that in common. I'm sure I don't know what you're talking about. There's a bitter warble in her voice. How dare you speak to me so, that I should be put in such a position? You're a clerk. And this is the kind of person. I thought of Gladys, and maybe this is off the wall, but as a Faulkner parallel, because Faulkner does some really good haters, you know. Remember the Jason in The Sound and the Fury, who he hates his sister or his niece or somebody's boyfriend, and he goes around saying, what kind of goddamn man would wear a red tie, you know? And you remember that? And Gladys is sort of like, you know, she just hates people. And it's a wonderful, because interestingly, most of the other characters are pretty positive and kind, you know. Some of them may have emotional difficulties, particularly the enigmatic Lola, but they're good, and they try to take care of each other, and you know, I mean, it's not cliched, but it's nice, except for Gladys, who is just the star hater. I don't know. Did you think that was possibly a Faulkner parallel? Tell me quick, because we got to do another break.
Well, I think again, you know, Phillips focuses on working class people. These are people that work all the time. They're not always the most educated, although some of them, even though they're, you know, working class people, they're very well read. Mm-hmm. They read a lot. They're not ignorant. They know the world around them in some respects, but they're just, you know, caught up in the lower class, working class, and they have troubles getting by, and they do suffer some financial pains. But I think it's in terms of Faulkner. Faulkner does have, you know, lots of people that are poor, that are struggling, and some of them are not very well read or very well educated. But you know, and of course, what Faulkner has that I think so far Phillips doesn't engage in. Faulkner has black folks, and Phillips doesn't, and I find that really interesting, and maybe it could be explained simply by the segregation that existed in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Where black folks simply did not enter the realm of wherever white folks were at, and maybe that was part of what Gladys's problem was, that a descent into the lower class was also a descent into diversified environments.
It seems to me there's something in here about racism, but I can't remember what it is, and we are overdue for another break.
Get ready for a mind-blowing musical journey on uncharted frequencies. Join us as we dive deep into the dynamic world of San Marcos 7866. Musicians where sensational instrumentalists and mesmerizing musicians merge. Prepare to be captivated by their extraordinary talents and transported to a realm of rhythmic enchantment. Don't miss out on this electrifying expedition into the heart of musical genius.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections. Now on exhibition, I Pray You Survive, Writing on the Edge. The Whitliff explores how our best writers have personally confronted life or death situations, from war to pandemics, race riots, and murder, to create their groundbreaking work. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please contact us at thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, you are back on Bookmark, where we are talking with Dr. Jaime Mejia about Jane Ann Phillips's novel of the Korean War and its consequence, some consequences at home, Lark and Termite. And we were talking about kind of odd, there are some almost mystical moments in this, or magical. I mean, you were talking about Termite's consciousness and how he really seems to see and perceive things that other people do not. And there is a character in here who is almost, I don't know, a ghost or something. He appears as he knocks on the door and says that he is from social services when Lark and Termite are home alone. Lark, we didn't say Lark is 17, so that helps, and Termite is 9. And he talks to her and he says, well, Termite could use a different kind of wheelchair, because the one they have for him is something he likes, but it's very cumbersome, and this is something that's much more mobile. And eventually he comes back and actually gives him the wheelchair. But he looks kind of funny, and when Lark describes him to Noni, she says, oh, well, I guess he's an albino from how you describe him. But he just seems really strange. I mean, this is the way Lark thinks about him. Stamble's white blonde hair is only a shade or two lighter than Termite's, and his light eyes would seem as startling if they weren't so pale and weak and narrow set. It's almost as though Stamble and Termite are related versions of something, but Stamble walks around in the world and Termite doesn't. Stamble's invisible to people except as an oddity like Termite, but he's not so set apart that people don't expect things of him. He has a job and a suit, but he stands and moves in his own peculiar leaning away stance. He keeps a distance, like he's careful, not used to himself. I love that phrase. He's got nothing to help him out but that suit and the hat that covers his pale hair and shades his face. Everything is gone from Stamble. You can tell by looking. He's passing through. He's visiting. Who is this anyway?
Robert Stamfill, and I take the first name as Robert, as parallel to Robert Levitt, who's the father of Termite. I see Stamble as being symbolic of, because he disappears.
Right. If you don't mind my going ahead and describing this, we've already said that Lark and Termite take refuge in the attic of their house during the flood, and then their neighbor, Solly, who is also Lark's boyfriend, comes and rescues them, and Lark sees, and apparently Termite sees him too, although we can't be entirely sure, Lark sees Stamble in the boat with them, and she sees him fall into the water, although Solly says, no, there's no one else in the boat, Lark. The boat moves, the boat will find the river in the flood, and the flood will open. The flood can turn and spin, a froth and fall like music. Stamble's cool, pale light is in the air. Termite feels that, this is Termite's point of view, the dark branch reach under them, pronged like a hand with fingers. The boat slams and screams, and he wants to go, but Stamble goes, flung like a white cloth, furled out and diving deep. Stamble spirals down and in the heavy water, finding the dark and the shapes and the light in the curve. But Lark sees him too and says, we have to go back and get him. And Sally says, there's nobody else in the boat.
Later in the narrative, Lark will call the Office of Social Services looking for Stamble. And the woman who answers the phone at Social Services tells her that there's no one named Stamble who works there. No one at all. So he's become a true mystery in the novel. We wonder, well, who is he and what's he doing here? Why is he claiming to be a social worker or working for social services? Why did he bring a wheelchair for a Termite? And so, you know, he doesn't exist. He seems not to exist, and then he disappears in the flood. So a very interesting character for sure. And of course, you know, as you read the novel, you can come to your own conclusions about who he is.
Yeah, I couldn't decide who he was, but he did seem in some ways a manifestation of the father, and there's a vision that Termite has near the end in the flood. He sees his father clear against the light, and his father turns and walks. His father has a boy like him and a girl like Lark. He takes them with them out of the tunnel. And some reviewers have pointed out Robert is trapped in the tunnel with this Korean family, an old woman who I don't know if there's a parallel with her with another Virginia character or not, but
with Gladys.
Yeah, with Gladys, you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, because she is kind of angry and hateful, and a young girl and her, and he can't figure out if it's her son or her brother, but there's the young woman sort of who is caring for this disabled boy, and so there he is with this. These people who foreshadow, you know, the family or the family that might have been his, you know. I don't know.
What we know about Stamble, if anything, it's he definitely has an interest in caring for Termite.
Yeah.
He presents himself as caring and caring specifically for him. And yeah. I think it's an interesting element that the author has thrown in is you know, another force of good that has entered into the picture to help, you know, someone like Termite.
Yeah, and there are a lot of forces, and there are other parallels that I remember the blind Korean boy in the tunnel moves his fingers in a way that's similar to the way that we later see Termite move his fingers, and the water, the bridge, the tunnel. Termite loves. He likes, I couldn't quite visualize exactly what happens, but Lark likes to take Termite out in a wagon and where he can be close to the train going by because he likes to feel the vibrations and all that. And so there's railroad tunnels, water, ghostly figures, all of these things, you know, pull this together.
And there's also danger.
Yeah. You know, it is also, it's so dangerous. Maybe not something she should be doing with a disabled kid, but he loves it. And there's the ending. It's has a wonderful dramatic moment that you are not allowed to reveal, but it does end in some ways kind of hopefully. Although the flood takes everything away, and we don't know exactly what's we're not completely sure what's going to happen.
I think. Jane Ann Phillips is a romantic, and I think she's an idealist. And while it's, you know, situated around working class people who have struggles and tragedies, including war in Korea, I think Phillips is very hopeful and very idealistic. And in the end, I think very romantic. And that,
yeah,
you know, she does end hopefully, and she ends with the kind of ending that for a good story to end with, there's a satisfaction at the end. I think,
yeah,
that I think that's what good writers do. At least in this story, mm-hmm. It's not a bleak story, although there are many bleak moments throughout. I'm very happy about this author. Mm-hmm. I'm glad to know her. I just finished reading her last novel, and it's very similar.
Having read that one, would you also say that, without maybe telling the story, but would you also say that she shows up as a romantic with a, you know, in that one as well?
Absolutely. I think at least these two novels have led me to believe Phillips is certainly a romantic. And then, the last novel is again filled with some very war and tragic things happen. But at the same time, there's hope. There are good things. There's also mysticism and spirituality as well that operate in interesting ways in her novel.
Yeah.
And again, I think she plays the spiritualism and the mysticism in very poetic ways.
Right. Anything we haven't talked about that you'd like our listeners to think about? I mean, obviously, we both are pretty impressed with this novel and recommend reading it.
You know, it's not often, in my view, although I'm now reading more than ever, and it's not often you run across a writer and a story that is so, in some ways, hopeful, but so well-crafted. Mm-hmm. You have to keep an eye on what she's doing.
Yeah.
I had to read this book twice, and I know that in the second time I read it, I'm picking up part of the craft that she's incorporated in telling the story that, in my view, you know, she's an impressive writer.
She is, and it's wonderful how she weaves all this stuff together. And we didn't mention, but I have to say something about Lola, who, although I wasn't crazy about the name because it seems like such a cliched temptress name, and Lola is, you know, you have to read the novel to meet Lola, but you don't meet Lola very much except in the minds of other people, which is another really beautiful piece of writing craft that Phillips uses.
What I like
uses.
About Lola is that she's a jazz singer. She works in a nightclub and she sings, and that's how she meets Robert Levitt, who she ends up marrying.
Yeah.
And Robert Levitt himself is a jazz trumpeter.
Yeah.
And that whole element of jazz in the novel, I like jazz a great deal.
Yeah, me too. Oh, then I think I have to end on one last note. There are three epigraphs, two of which we've kind of mentioned. Well, one of them is to do with the origin of the word gook, which refers indirectly to the massacre, because the fact that anybody who is Korean looks suspect, so that's a factor. The other is a quote from The Sound and the Fury. And the third is a couple of lines from the song Funny Valentine, which Lola and Robert perform together in the novel where she works. And I love that because they create Funny Valentine, and they have, as we learn through the novel, created a Funny Valentine in the form of Termite, who is, you know, I thought that was kind of cool. All right. Jaime Mejia, thank you so much for coming and being my guest.
Thanks.
All right. And as always, thank you for listening.